And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. How do Marxism and feminism fit together? If we consult history, the answer is not very well at all. Marxists tend to pin their hopes on the working class, on people who work for a wage. Many feminists focus not on class, but on gender, on what happens to women, waged or not, because they are women. Into this arena of ideas and activism entered Selma James, who refused to separate her uncompromising advocacy of women from her attraction to Marxian class analysis. James did a lot of thinking and a ton of organizing, and she famously coined the term unwaged to describe work done by housewives and subsistence farmers. She's also written provocatively about the schooling of children, the international hierarchy of labor, and the power relations within the working class. Selma James is a London-based women's rights and anti-racist campaigner and author. Her new book, Sex, Race, and Class, The Perspective of Winning, is a collection of 5 decades of her writings. In 1972, she founded the International Wages for Housework campaign, and in 2000, she helped launch the Global Women's Strike. Her books include The Power of Women and the Subversion of Community, Marx and Feminism, and Women, the Unions, and Work. When Selma James, who is on book tour, joined me in our KPFA studios, I began by asking her about the importance of the wage and what's called the wage relation to the capitalist system.
Well, that's really fundamentally the mechanism for exploitation. It is through a thing, that is the wage, through money, that the relationship between the waged worker and the capitalist is expressed. And the capitalist, you go to a capitalist and you say, exploit me, please. And he says, well, all right. And he says the wages are so much per week, that means so much per hour. And if you have no choice, you say, I'm glad to accept. And then he puts your labor power to work. He puts your ability to work to use for him. And you make more than he pays you. That is, you get $50, but you make $100 for him, or most likely $300 for him. And that's a fair exchange because you have agreed to be at his disposal for 40 hours for the $50.
Well, the fact that you've agreed to it doesn't necessarily mean it's fair, does it?
No, well, it doesn't. The fact that you've agreed to it with him, you had to agree to it with somebody because that was your only possibility of an income. And that wage, exactly how much that wage is, tells you how many other people want that job. And Marx put it very clearly. He said the wage is determined outside of the factory, that is, by how many people are there who want that work. And you got it, and you're so glad to get it. You're so glad for the thrill of being exploited. Unfortunately, you have no choice. So the wage relation is the power relation between you and your employer, but it's also the power relation between you and those in your family who don't have wages, because since you have the autonomy of the wage, that is, you can pick yourself up and ask another employer to exploit you. The fact that you have that ability to make decisions within a very strict framework distinguishes you from others. For example, if you have a wife, it distinguishes you from her because she works, but she doesn't get a wage. In fact, she's working for the same employer that you are because she's making sure you turn up for work the next day.
And we will talk much more about that. You write that capital is not a thing, not a set or series of things, but a social relation. By that social relation, do you mean the wage relation, or are there other social relations involved?
Well, the wage relation is so fundamental to the society, that's the first thing we would mean. That is, that power relation, that dependence on others exploiting you, is absolutely the central relation of capital. But on that is built other things. For example, the unwaged relation, that is, the woman or others who have no wage, who are dependent on you. And on an international level, most people don't have wages. There's no wage to depend on. You depend on your subsistence farming, for example, or other little jobs you get here and there in the non-industrial world. And that's not the same as it once was, because what you can produce now unaided is very much less. There's ecological devastation, which has really hit women, the farmers, probably the hardest in the world. You know, you cannot make food for your family when there's a drought and then when there's a flood. And it's also hit you because so much of what you used to produce in the community is not produced there anymore, but comes in the form of an import which you cannot afford. So the point is, you didn't used to be an unwaged worker when there weren't wages in the world. But once there are wages in the world and you don't get any, then you are in a much more dependent situation on whatever happens, no doubt in your country, but also outside of your country by the imperial power, at least the most powerful states.
I wonder to what extent the factory has been viewed as the center of production in capitalist society, both by elites, by the state, and the left.
Yes, by the elites and by the left. I'm so glad you said that, because the standards of the factory, which is the standard of capital, the state, employers, is also the priority, has also been the priority of the left almost exclusively. You know, I've worked in factories not to experiment or do sociological work, but to feed myself and my family. And there is some idea that when you go to work in a factory, you have a high consciousness and many good things happen to you. It ain't nothing good happening there. And not only that, but if you're a woman, you know very well that when you're finished one day in the factory, you have another day waiting for you when you get home, because there is all the reproductive work that needs doing. And it's exhausting, and it's very hard to concentrate on the care of people when you are exhausted by the work in the waged workplace, that is, not only a factory, a call center, stacking shelves in supermarkets, whatever work women and men are doing, it's exhausting. It takes your time, and that, by the way, happens to be your life, and it takes your energy, and it takes your possibilities, and then you're supposed to have a life outside, and there isn't a lot left to live.
And when you said reproductive work, you don't mean just reproduction of human beings. You mean the act of caring, all the time and effort that takes, correct?
Yes, because if you're a woman, you may give birth. But what if you're like the woman I met just a few hours ago who didn't have children and has decided not to? But there's a lot of reproductive work she has to do. She has to fix herself up every day to go to work. She has an auntie who's ill. She has a cousin who needs her help. She has neighbors who are dependent perhaps on what she will do. You are a carer. If you are a woman, you're defined as the carer. Now, I want to make it absolutely clear, I'm not saying that women should not be carers. I'm saying women should not be the only ones who are carers, because that reproductive work of helping others, of caring for others, is to reproduce the human race and to reproduce society. And it is a civilizing influence that I might add that men are often deprived of.
Well, what you are saying, Selma James, goes against the common understanding that the family is somehow separate from the economic system, that it's sort of a private realm of relative freedom and of leisure, and it's separate from the capitalist system. That is precisely the opposite of what you are arguing, correct?
That is correct. And I have to go back to the question you asked earlier about the left. You know, the left has always assumed not only that the production is central, which is what capital and the market presume, but that workers are more powerful there, and therefore that's what they, as people who want to change the world, have to concentrate on, to the neglect of everybody else. And the family unit, the work that goes on in the family is not outside of capitalist society. If you are a woman who has a husband working nights, you know who you're working for, because your whole life is geared to getting that man to work and reproducing, repairing him so that he's able to do the next day's work, whatever schedule that means for you. But in addition to that, whatever is going on in organizing in the factory or the workplace, the waged workplace, a lot is going on in the community, among women, among neighbors, among volunteers, within cities, and now with Occupy, that's absolutely clear. And I think that Occupy cuts across some of those divisions that are presumed to be indelible within the working class, within the grassroots, within the working community in its widest sense, because it says we're 99% against the 1%. It's not exactly a statistic, but it's a figure on which we can build a movement, or at least begin to build a movement. Those of us who work for wages and those of us who work without wages, we can organize together. We must organize together, but we can only do that if the division between waged and unwaged is addressed. We can't organize together unless we deal with the power relations, first of all, between women and men, in the sense that not being the sex with the money, even the little money, it has wide implications for everything in your life as a woman, whether you're presumed to have the right to have control over your own reproduction, whether you have the money to have children, whether you have the money to have an abortion, and the kinds of work you do outside the home as well as inside, and how much you get paid for it. You see, when you go to the employer as a woman and you say, exploit me, please, he says, well, since you're a woman, you don't have anything anyway, I'll give you a lot less than the men. And you say, no, but I'm doing the same job, or at least I'm doing work of equal value. And he will tell you, I'm sorry, I can get somebody else to do it instead of you. There are a lot of women waiting for your job. And again, the thing applies that you have to take what he gives you. So the power relation between women and men has wide implications. The same thing is true between the industrial world and the non-industrial world. People are not crowding to get into Uganda or to get into Thailand. They're crowding to get into the United States and to the Western European countries because the jobs are there, the money is there, the money is not where they came from, and they've come to get it. And that power relation expresses itself again in wages. You know, you can look at the wages of white men, white women, black men, black women, Latino men, Latino women, immigrant women, immigrant men. And you can get a picture in wages of the social relationships in the society, the power relations in society. And it's not only in society in general, but it's also within the grassroots. There are power relations among us, and we have to deal with those in order to deal with those who are ensuring that those divisions continue.
Selma James is a veteran women's rights and anti-racist campaigner and author. Her new book is Sex, Race, and Class, The Perspective of Winning, a selection of writings 1952 to 2011, published by PM Press. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song, and I just want to read something from your new book, your new collection, which touches on what you were saying earlier about the unwaged nature of household work. You write that housewives are involved in the production and what is the same thing, reproduction of workers, what Marx calls labor power. They, the housewives, service those who are daily destroyed by working for wages and who need to be daily renewed, and they care for and discipline those who are being prepared to work when they grow up. This, of course, has to do with your contention, which I think is indisputable, that women and the family are absolutely critical to the continuation of the capitalist system. Now, you've already begun to talk about this, but let's maybe make things a little more explicit, because the big question arises, and you pose it a lot in your writings, what does all this have to do with class, right? We talk about injustices done to women, and people think, well, we are talking only or primarily about gender and not class. In fact, you've written the following: equal pay may be about workers, but is abortion, sterilization, housework, rape, divorce, child custody and care, lesbianism, dress, personality, orgasms? The question centers, doesn't it, on how we define class, how we define the working class.
Well, it depends on whether or not women and others who are considered marginal are considered part of the working class. I want to deal with that first, which is we started not to use the word working class and start to use the word grassroots, because we found women married to men with some money identify with others who are also doing the reproductive work without wages, without recognition. The work is not considered work if you don't get wages for it. And we were anxious for them to be part of our movement, and therefore grassroots covered that. On the other hand, there has been a grave misunderstanding of who the working class is from quite another point of view. You know, we are all individuals, and when we are individuals in the capitalist system, we are denied real choices, real possibilities, and to discover ourselves and our potential. And all of the issues that we raise about how we live our lives, how we relate to others in the society, are class issues to the degree that we as individuals are incapable of making those choices, because we live in a repressive world which is dominated by our need to be exploited. So that all the issues of being human are the issues of class. We are denied our own humanity. And it's not, as sometimes is said, that we will just take our humanity back. It's not so easy. You have to get rid of those restraints on your time and on your movements and on your possibilities in order to begin to discover together, because you don't discover it alone, but you discover it with the society, what you want your life to be like. I think that's really crucial, because we've heard in the left the words "the masses." It just grates me when I hear that. There's no masses. There are billions of individuals who are together, social individuals who are together in the society, and what the society appears to need and what they need as individuals is often in conflict. It certainly is if you are a woman. And what we want is a society where what the individual needs for his or her own development is one with what the society needs for its development. That's what Marx was aiming at, the social individual, the individual who is entirely within society.
Now, as you know, a lot of women are not working class, right? They have a fair amount of money. Perhaps they make a lot of money themselves, or they are associated with somebody who does and who supports them. How do we see them as fitting into a class analysis and fitting into a class struggle?
Well, first of all, there is a whole set of women today who are part, who have joined the elite, who don't have problems with pay equity anymore, because in the boardroom they get more or less what the other boardroom members get. And people have begun to speak about the fact that the class line among women has been much more severely drawn now with feminism than it was before. They have not got our interests at heart. In the last Labour election, that was 1997, 100 members of the House of Commons in England, in Britain, I beg your pardon, were women. And the first thing that the women did was one of their number announced that the money for single mothers was going to be cut. When Tony Blair said that women were workless, that is, women who didn't go out of the home to work were workless, it didn't bother them. They didn't feel attacked by it as they should have been, because it was really an attack on the work that women are forced to do. They wanted to obliterate from view the unwaged work that women did, so we would all go out to work, that nobody would need welfare. We would then go back home and be liberated to do another day, and capital would benefit. They weren't protecting us. They had joined the other side. On the other hand, there are women who have never been part of an elite. They have been appendages to their husbands' jobs. You know, when the Wages for Housework campaign first began in the 70s, one of our members was married to the head of Chrysler Europe. And she said, I work for Chrysler, he works for Chrysler, but I work for Chrysler too. And I don't get wages from anybody. And I absolutely identify with unwaged housewives all over the world and want to organize as part of the Wages for Housework campaign. We were delighted. She had a whole story to tell about the corporate wife and how she was enslaved by the corporation. And the women who had very little, who had much less than she had, quite welcomed her, understood her position, knew how it felt from their own point of view. We could work together. We could build a movement together. And we want that possibility.
Selma James joins me in our KPFA studios. She founded the International Wages for Housework campaign in 1972. She is coordinator of the Global Women's Strike, which she helped launch in 2000. The author or co-author of many books, including The Power of Women and the Subversion of Community, Marx and Feminism, Stranger and Sisters, and Women, the Unions, and Work. And the first book I mentioned, by the way, she co-authored with Maria Rosa de la Costa. And her new book is a collection of writings, a selection of her writings over five decades. It's called Sex, Race, and Class, The Perspective of Winning. So what is the consequence, in your opinion, of women's movements, some women's movements, seeing gender as fundamental, but not class?
Well, I think that a lot of women would like to believe that gender is the only thing that matters because it makes them employable. That is, they can say then there are not enough women represented and get a job. But it's much more complicated than that if you are a woman who wants to be liberated and who wants to live in a liberated society, which is the only way you can be liberated. In that case, you have to say, well, there are women and women. There are women who are farmers in third world countries. There are women who are facing, as Trayvon's mother is, the death of her son because of their race, and who have a struggle which is particular to that sector of society, but which all of us really are engaged in. We have to see the particularities of each woman's situation, each sector of women's situation. And you can't pay attention only to your gender and to one segment of your gender if you want to be liberated. If you deal only with gender, you compete with others who deal only perhaps with race, who deal only perhaps with disability. We want every particularity, but we don't want any competition. It doesn't help us, and it doesn't change the world because it doesn't build a movement. And this is really the purpose of forming a women's movement, is because we want a change, not only for ourselves, a few of us changing, but all of us changing the world together. You have to find out what it is that other women want to struggle for and what it is that men are struggling for that you need to know about, support, and urge to support you. And this is what we have been trying to do. We have an international network, and women who are domestic workers in Peru are in that. Women who are fighting racism among Afro, Indo, and indigenous Guyanese, they're involved in our network, etc. Every single country is involved in the struggle where they are and also incorporates the struggle of other countries into what they are thinking and doing so we can act together on an international level and increasingly. This is what we want. We want Payday, a network of men to be working with us as they are now, who say that refusing to kill is not a crime. These are men who are organizing with people who refuse to be in the army or part of the military, who refuse to go to Afghanistan and who refuse to kill people for the Turkish government. So in that way, we come together because we all want society to invest in caring rather than in killing. In fact, that's our slogan. And we all see our own fate as united in that and can work together across differences. Now, that's not to say that the differences disappear, but we address them so that each of us is enhanced by the struggle of others.
Selma James is her name. She is perhaps most famous for her assertion that the unwaged work of women as carers, as household workers, as housewives, should be recognized as labor and compensated. So who should pay? Who should be held responsible for paying the wages of women who do housework?
When we say that unwaged workers are also working for capital, we want the state to pay, and we want the money to come, first of all, from the military budget. That's who we're demanding the money from. We are against war. All of us know that it's not this or that, but every war that we want to abolish. And we want to make it clear that our money, the money that we are entitled to and have not got, should come from that military, because caring is the opposite of killing. You know, the kind of work that women do really makes it possible for the human race to be reproduced. And I want to give one example, and that's breastfeeding. It's an area of women's work which the left has really fundamentally neglected or ignored. Women give, in most parts of the world, give infants, the new birth, the new human being, what they need, which is breast milk. It's made for the baby, it's made for the mother, and together they bring new life. Women are told that that's not good enough. What we should really do is go out to work and get some formula to feed our infants. It's the first junk food. After that, McDonald's is not far down the road. Is that what we want our society to be like? Is that the world that we want to recreate? In many parts of Africa, I've seen where women have organized against formula so that they can continue to give the infants the food that they need. And yet, in some way, it's considered a bit primitive for mothers to be giving milk to the infant, milk from her own body. And yet, it's because the reproduction of the human race has plunged as a social priority that we can even consider that women going out to work is more important than women feeding new life.
To what extent is baby formula being pushed upon women in Africa and other countries?
Oh, it's horrendous. Some governments have made deals with the formula companies that they're to give out free packets. And of course, once the women use the formula, then the breast milk dries up and it's very hard to get it back again. And we know that it means the death of many infants as a result of that. And yet, somehow, when it has to do with women, it's not political. This is highly political. This is the survival of the human race, and yet it's dismissed. It's one of these things that women do. You know, it's biological and can easily be replaced by what a machine can produce. It is the market's view of the human race, which is that we are secondary to it. And that's what we're really all of us fighting about. We say not the market, but the human race must be the priority, and the priority for production and priority for the organization of society in every aspect. So when we say invest in caring, not killing, we're saying invest in the human race, not in the destruction of the human race. I think that's a very reasonable demand.
Sounds reasonable to me. I'm CS. Selma James joins me in our KPFA Berkeley studios. She is a London-based women's rights and anti-racist campaigner and author. There is a new book, a collection of her writings over many decades, that's just come out from PM Press. It's called Sex, Race, and Class, The Perspective of Winning, a selection of writings 1952 to 2011. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. We'll take a short music break and talk more with Selma James. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. Selma James, veteran activist, campaigner, and author, joins me in our studios. She founded the International Wages for Housework campaign. She's international coordinator of the Global Women's Strike, and she's written a number of very influential books, including The Power of Women and The Subversion of Community, that she co-authored with Maria Rosa Dalla Costa. Selma, you've written provocative things about school and its function in capitalist society. So what is the purpose in your mind of taking children out of the home and having them attend school?
Well, I think, first of all, that capitalism is the only society where the children of the exploited are given over to the state to educate. In previous societies, they stayed with us, and they learned from us, and they worked with us. It's true they didn't go to school, but then they weren't put against us either. And I think that...
What does that mean, put against us?
Well, I think that children are taught in school not about our history as working class people, not about our struggles, not about our conditions of life, not about our budgets. You know, it would be wonderful if children in school were able to look at the relative budgets of different strata in the society. I'd like to know, you know, how much the middle class lives on per week, and how much working class people live on, and how much people live on who have been on welfare and have been thrown off in workfare now, where they work practically for nothing. How much do they have in their pockets? That's what the school should teach children about the actual lives that people are living. But instead, we are given myths about history. We're taught arithmetic. I mean, that at least. And so many children come out of school are still illiterate in this country and in the UK as well. And that is entirely unacceptable. What is it that the children are being taught that they can't learn to read? Children usually can learn to read. They teach themselves fundamentally. The teacher makes it possible and makes it easier, but children learn to read by themselves, really. And the children that we send to school do not get what I would consider an education. They are not prepared for the lives that they are going to live, except they are given skills that will prepare them to get a job. I remember being at home one day with a friend, and her neighbor came in and said, you know, this happened in school to my seven-year-old. He was treated badly. He was the butt of racist remarks by the teacher. And then she said, they're choosing the street sweepers now, meaning that her son was marked already to be one of the street sweepers rather than a higher level in the society. And I think that tells you something about what education is. So does the question of student loans, how people for life are paying off for their education because they think they may not get a job unless they have that education. But I wanted to make another point, which is really crucial to me, and that is that parents want their children educated. They want their children to get a, quote, good education. That is, they want their children to have the skills that will enable them to have a good life, first of all, financially. And I think there's something else that has to be mentioned, at least mentioned, where education is concerned. We educate our children to rise out of poverty, but we don't educate our children to help everyone to rise out of poverty. And I raise that with kids in Haiti, for example, which is one of the poorest countries in the Americas. They have been the subject of all kinds of invasions and coups by the United States, France, and now an occupation by the United Nations, which is American-inspired. And they have to make a decision about what they are going to school for. And that's true in every country of the world. Are we rising out of poverty ourselves, competing with others, pushing others aside? Or can we all use our education or demand the education that will enable us to destroy that which keeps us all poor? You know, can we get that kind of education? It's not the place here to speak about the kinds of societies that people were trying to build in the 60s and 70s in a number of countries. But there were some attempts to educate children, to enhance the community, to develop the community, rather than to rise above the community so that they no longer even could speak to their own parents or have the concerns and interests of the people who put them in this elevated position.
Well, your evaluation of schools as an institution designed specifically by the ruling class to prepare young people to become cogs in the capitalist machine, that militates against any sense that, hey, maybe schools could do different things and inculcate children with different values, right?
Not exactly. There have been movements, for example, welfare mothers in the 60s and 70s wanted to make the school responsive to the community's needs and for children to be educated to enhance the community. That's a struggle that the working class has been involved in many places. They want to impose an education on you, but you want to impose your concern about the children being liberated through education and being trained to help the whole community to be liberated, and education as an important part of that. I think that's part of the class struggle. There is a class struggle in education. They want to do one thing with us, but we want to do something quite other with these few resources that they allow us to have in education, and we want more resources. We want more education to be musicians. We want more sports and sporting fields where children can exercise their bodies as well as their minds. There are a lot of things that children should have, and they have a right to them. You know, our children are really badly treated by the whole society. And of course, there is not only the general education, which is an education for repressors. Sit in that chair. Do not move. Do not talk. Well, I don't think a small child should be given those kinds of orders. They have a lot to say for themselves, and we should be dying to hear everything that is. But there's also the question that there are more and more children on the street who have nothing to eat. There are more and more children who are taken from their families because the mother is poor, so they take the child because they can't distinguish between neglect and poverty. Excuse me. Neglect is when you neglect the child. Poverty is when you and your child are neglected and punished for it. And when children are not important in the society, that means nobody is important. And I think children are crucial, and we should understand and act on the basis that we must deal with every problem that children have, and then we will be dealing with most of the problems of society.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Selma James is a veteran women's rights campaigner and writer and organizer. She was the close colleague of and is the widow of the influential Caribbean theoretician, historian, writer C.L.R. James. And I wish we had time to talk about the Johnson Forest tendency, and hopefully we can have you back to talk about C.L.R. James's politics, which still interests you very much, and your development within that political movement. So the demand of many activist women has been women should have more access to jobs for which they get fair wages. Women should have more freedom to be able to move out of the unwaged household and enter the job market. How would you evaluate that demand?
You know, I did that work. I'm past a, quote, working age, although I think I work very hard. And I know about the fact that the work outside the home is not glamorous and does not enhance your life, most of it. Some of it does. And I think that people should have access to work that suits them, that pleases them, and that all work that is repetitive and boring should be abolished. You know, I think the working week anyway should be cut in half immediately, and from there go down, because there's no reason for us to be working all these hours that we are working. We have no time for a life outside of work, and we have no time even to consider what we want to do, whether it's this work we want to do. I don't believe that going out to work is liberation, except in some circumstances. I mean, it must be true sometime, but most women go to work that they don't love and sometimes are very happy to go to that job because it means they have a social life, because it means they get out, and because it means they have money in their hand that belongs to them, that nobody can take away, except, of course, the government takes its cut before you get it. And that's really a dilemma, that the only job you can go to have your financial independence and to be your own person and to be with other people all day rather than locked in a house is to a job that you don't like. There's something wrong with the society where that's the only choice that's available to you. That's not reasonable. We shouldn't have to choose between two difficulties, two tragedies, because you have to remember you're only here for so long in this world, and you've got to make every minute count and try to learn and enjoy all the hours that are there.
Well, one response to the economic difficulties we are having on a large scale is austerity, and governments have been cutting social services. What burden does that place on women who do housework? And is the taking on of this burden part of the government's calculations?
It certainly is part of government's calculations. What we've always said is women's work is not counted, but it's counted on. And that's the thing, you know. If you lose your job, somehow you try to find someone else who can help you to make it financially. If you lose your social services, you replace them as a woman. If you haven't got medical facilities, you become the nurse. You become also, I think, the doctor. Every single cut in social services has meant more unwaged work for women. And that's because our work is not waged. If that work that we did, social service work, were always waged, they would have to think twice about our doing more of it because they'd have to pay for more of the work to be done. But because we are unwaged, we are the eminent shock absorbers of every economic crisis. We're the ones who will live on less and do with less ourselves in order to see that others eat, etc. You know, before the welfare state in Britain, everybody knew that women never went to doctors. Men went to doctors because they had to stay healthy to be able to go on working, but women didn't go and lived with pain for years and years because that was not a resource that the family could afford to expend on women's health. Let's take a lesson from that, because to the degree that services are cut, to that degree, women first and foremost are impoverished. We will see our children eating first before we eat ourselves. That's true all over the world. That's not because women have, you know, are specially generous. It's because we take seriously the responsibility for caring for those we love. And that's what happens. In the same way as when men are in trouble with the law, you know, millions of men are or have been in prison. And who does the justice work? Who runs around from one lawyer's office to another? Who stands on the line waiting to see the prisoner with a little something that it costs you a lot to buy and cost a lot in doing without in order to get it? It's the women. And we have, you know, in the campaign in England, we say mothers, daughters, sisters, wives fighting for our loved ones' lives. And in case anybody is confused and say, but that's not feminism, well, I beg to disagree, or else we can't use the word, because women know that it's in their interest, in our interest, to fight for men who are suffering injustice. Women's justice work is an important part of the caring work that women have always done and never got credit for. A few years ago, well, that's about 20 years ago, we put a picket line around the major court in Britain, not against the court itself, but against the lawyers who were representing 16 young men, young black men, who were being prosecuted unjustly. And we said, the mothers said they wanted the lawyers' fees for themselves because they were doing more justice work than the lawyers were. And we had a big impact on the lawyers because they understood that they couldn't get through with their sloth and had to do a little work for a change.
Selma James, in one of the essays in this book, Sex, Race, and Class, The Perspective of Winning, this new collection of writings of yours from 1952 to 2011, you write that the point of organizing is to unite. And then you write, the question is, who unites with whom? Do we, and here you're talking about autonomous women's movements, unite with the men, or do they unite with us? And you kind of conclude this passage by writing that, quote, those with more power must unite with those of us with less, because we know better what their interests are than they know themselves. How so?
You know, I remember my mother telling my father, you think that so-and-so is going to help the workers, and she knew it that was not true. You know, women are often much more aware of what the social relations are, what the actual power relations are in any struggle, and tell the men which end is up, and if they're smart, they listen. But in addition to that, women have always not only supported men's struggles, but made it clear how broad are the implications of that struggle, and have said, you know, if he doesn't get a raise, our children are going to be in difficulty. His mother is dependent on him giving her something every week. A whole set of people are dependent on what he is able to bring home, and we are fighting for all of them. That's why we must support the men. You know, in so many ways, women are aware of the relations and aware of the implications of men's struggle, and many men have recognized that. I think I want to remind your audience of one particular incident. You know, the Wobblies, Industrial Workers of the World, were an extraordinary group. But especially in the south of the United States, they organized white and black together, which was illegal, but they were principled. And at one point, they were talking about going out on strike. This was in Louisiana, I believe. And one man said, look, I think we shouldn't take this vote here. We should ask the women to come and vote with us. And then another guy said, look, I'm not opposing you, but I want to make absolutely sure you're asking that the women vote on the strike, on whether we strike. And he said, yes, because they have to hear the hungry children cry. We don't, and they must come here. And then the whole Wobbly branch voted for the women to be there to vote on the strike, because it was the women who had to bear the implications, the suffering that would follow with the strike vote, and therefore they had a right to decide about it.
Selma James, influential thinker, writer, and campaigner, founded the International Wages for Housework campaign in 1972, coordinator of the Global Women's Strike. Her new book is Sex, Race, and Class, The Perspective of Winning, a selection of writings 1952 to 2011. It's just out from PM Press. Links on againstthegrain.org to that book and to Selma's other work. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Selma James will be speaking tonight at 6:30 in Oakland at The Holdout, 2313 San Pablo Avenue, on the topic of gender, sex, race, and class in the Occupy movement and beyond. We've put a link to James's tour events on our website, againstthegrain.org. And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, and it's free. You can sign up for our podcast there. You can give us a call at 510-848-6767, extension 670. And you might want to check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. Many thanks to the heroic Jill Montgomery for all her help over the many months. She is at the controls today.